Last week, we saw the parting of Jacob from his host, Laban. So he was dwelling with Laban, and he had removed himself 3 days' journey, but was still tending Laban's flocks, was still under Laban's rule, earning Laban's wages. And so parting is sweet sorrow at this point in time. I'm sure he had come to know this area. And as you've been a part of something, whether it be a church or whether it be a position or a job or just an area of town that you've lived in, after you've been somewhere for so long, it becomes a place of comfort. It's a comfort zone. And so it's hard to leave, and yet sometimes we know we must. And so he's leaving Laban's house, and he's returning back to the house of his father. Well, he's leaving one problem for another. So he's departing from one problem, but he's going straight back to another. Let me remind you, his brother Esau swore to kill Jacob. And so there is a death threat. There's a wanted poster in the land of Canaan with Jacob's face on it, reward to be given by his brother Esau. And so jumping into Genesis 32, verse 1, it says, "So Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him." When Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." And he called the name of that place Mahanaim. So here he is, and he's made it halfway south into the land that we know now as Israel. And he sees these angels camping out. Now, I don't know about you, but it's not typical that I see angels like camping out somewhere. I think this would be quite the sight. And it doesn't say how he saw them. It doesn't say that he saw them by night or he saw them by day. We're not really sure what time of day it was. Topographically speaking, like I already mentioned, Mahanaim is in central Israel. It's between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, fairly close to the Jordan River, but it's actually on the banks of what's called the Jabbok River. And it's in this place that he sees this camp of angels. So he calls the place Mahanaim, which means two camps or two hosts. So there's Jacob's camp, and they're camping out here by this riverbank. And then there's the camp of the angels of the Lord. Now, again, what this looks like, we don't know. He doesn't tell us. Interesting scene to come upon, though. And it must have been comforting for Jacob to come upon this scene, because he realizes that only a few days' journey from where he's at this point in time, he'll be entering into the land of Edom, where Esau and his crew is living. So he realizes that he's got some big problems on his hands. He's going back to the land of his fathers, and he's bound to run into Esau, who has sworn to kill him. So he's leaving one trouble for another, and here's this camp of angels. It must have been very comforting. And I would suggest to you that as all the hype about angels in the world today, and you know, typically you see angels depicted as this beautiful female type figure with the feathers and the wings and the long white dress and the glow, and you know, the Bible never talks about angels in this way. Typically, the Bible talks about this big burly man, you know, that's just, you know, ready to rumble. You know, he's definitely, you know, built for war. And so you see this group of militant looking angels hanging out in the middle of Israel, and Jacob's just got to go, right on, man. This is God's camp. God's on my side, and God's sending me down here, and he's sending me with a troop of angels. So he must feel great comfort. And we ought to feel comfort too, as being children of God, those of us who have given their lives to God and believed in Jesus Christ for their salvation. There are camps of angels ready to war for us. They're ready to go to battle for us in that spiritual world. I just think that's awesome to think about. And so believe it, that God's got your back. Well, Genesis 32:3 says, "Then Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom." Seir means rough and hairy. So you can laugh at that. That's funny. So Jacob sent messengers to the land of rough and hairy. Now, I'm not sure that this is a place you'd want to settle. You know, like as you're thinking through, okay, where are we going to move the kids? We're looking for a good school system. You know, we're looking for, you know, a place with parks. And, you know, you're thinking Austin, you know, or rough and hairy. Now, I'm not sure which way to go, but I see Jacob, right? Jacob is talking to these messengers, and he comes along and says, "Hey, guys, I kind of need to send you with a message." And the guys are like, "Well, where are we going, Jacob?" And, "Well, I got to send you to Rough and Hairy." The guys are like, "Rough and Hairy? Where's that?" "Yeah, Rough and Hairy. Oh, and by the way, guys, you're going to need this." "What's this?" "It's moisturizer and a comb. You know, you're gonna need these things in Rough and Hairy." Well, Jacob explains what he wants these messengers to say. And in verse 4, someone just got that back there. That's good. "And he commanded them, saying, 'Speak thus to my lord Esau. Thus your servant Jacob says, I have dwelt with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen, donkeys, flocks, and male and female servants. And I have sent to tell my lord that I might find favor in your sight.'" And so you see these messengers, and they're sent to find out exactly the climate, the temperature of Esau and his crew. He wants to get a good report back from these messengers. And Jacob realizes that it's also rude to just stop by unannounced. So he sends with, they didn't have cell phones back then, so they send the messengers out. And the messengers come back with so-so news. And being that it's so-so news, it's almost kind of troubling in that it's just kind of like, well, what did he say? He said, okay. You know, well, what did he mean by that? What kind of tone was there? You could see him just wanting to know exactly what Esau was thinking. And so in verse 6, "Then the messengers returned to Jacob, saying, 'We came to your brother Esau, and he also is coming to meet you. And 400 men are with him.'" 400 men are with him? Yikes! "So Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that were with him, and the flocks and herds and camels into two companies. And he said, 'If Esau comes to the one company and attacks it, then the other company, which is left, will escape.'" So Jacob begins to think militarily. He begins to strategize and develop a plan of escape and determines that if he can separate the two groups out, well, then hopefully only one group will be attacked and the other can secretly, you know, stealthily, you know, flee and get away. But we see Jacob again resorting back to the same old Jacob that he's always been, right? I mean, the fact of the matter is that old habits are hard to break. Think about you in your own life. I mean, there are things that you wish you could stop, and you want to stop them right now, and you wish you couldn't do them anymore, but it's a habit. You're stuck in this way of thinking. You react certain ways when certain things happen, or you resort to this certain tactic whenever things get rough. Old habits are hard to break. And he's resorting back to old habits, the old habit of manipulation. He learned it from mom, and he's attempting to manipulate the situation to succeed in some way or another. He's thinking, hey, if all I do is lose half of what I've got, I've still got half of what I had. So I'm still winning to a certain degree. And then he remembers, wait a minute, God's on my side. Maybe I should talk to God. Wow. It's an epiphany. And so verse 9 says, "Then Jacob said, 'O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, the Lord who said to me, return to your country and to your family, and I will deal well with you. I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies and of all the truth which you have shown your servant. For I crossed over this Jordan with my staff, and now I have become two companies.'" I love the quote of Lisa Simpson. She walks into Bart's room, and he's on his knees asking God for one more chance to pass this important test, or else he's going to fail the grade that he's in. She walks by the door and sees the scene and says, "Prayer, the last refuge of a scoundrel." Well, this is the first recorded example of prayer in the Bible. Prayer is the first thing that we ought to go to when things become hard in our life. The minute things start going the wrong way, well, the first thing we ought to do is pray. As a matter of fact, before things go wrong, we ought to be in prayer so that things won't go wrong. If we were praying, maybe so many things wouldn't go wrong, because God typically allows things to go wrong in our lives to bring us to prayer because we're not praying. But when things start going wrong in our lives, if you're anything like me, then the first thing I do is I start thinking about all the ways that I can control the situation to make it work out in the way that I think is going to be best. Prayer is typically the thing that we start doing when all else has failed. We see prayer as a last resort. And so some see this step of Jacob here as a step in the right direction. Jacob has been trying to manipulate everything this whole time, but now he's finally getting on his knees and praying. And I'm not necessarily disagreeing with that. I do think it is a step in the right direction to a certain degree, but I don't read all the best intentions into Jacob's prayer here. I just wonder if Jacob isn't also now trying to manipulate God through his prayer. Anybody ever find themselves doing that? You know, oh God, if you would do this, then I'll do that. If you would just answer this prayer in this way, not any other way, God, but this way, then I'll serve you. I'll start serving in children's ministry. I'll, you know, start feeding that person on the street that I see as I pass by them every week. I'll start being nice to my spouse. We begin to bargain with God and try to manipulate the situation. We try to force God's hand by saying that we're going to be good. He knows we're not going to. Genesis 32:9 says this, "Then Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac." He appeals to this idea that, oh, you've been with my father and my father's father. "Oh, and God, remember, you're the Lord who said to me, return to your country. And you said, I will deal well with you." Now, it's not wrong to claim the promises of God in our prayers. We ought to. God has promised us many things throughout Scriptures, and we ought to pray those promises. And God, thank you for saying this, and God, thank you for saying that. God, thank you for promising this, and thank you for promising that. But he's not thanking God for his promises. He's only showing a lack of trust by saying, "Hey, God, remember, you said, I wouldn't be here if you didn't say." And so he's trying to manipulate God and say, "Oh, God, I mean, you said to do this, and so I'm doing it now, and it looks like I'm about to have hard times, and you know, that's not part of the deal here. You said you were going to do well for me." Guys, do we understand that what we think God doing well for us isn't always what God thinks God doing well for us is? That there are many times in our lives where we think we've been dealt the rough hand, and yet is exactly what God wanted for us, because he knew that it would be the very thing that would help to develop the character in us that he wanted to develop. That sometimes when we get the bad news, when we find out that the very thing that we were praying against is what happened, that all of those things are part of God's plan. And so to enter into a prayer of manipulation and try to start, "Well, God, remember, you promised that," it's only to delay your growth, not to actually force God to do what you think he should do in the first place. So what we really ought to do is use prayer as it was designed. Prayer is designed to bring us into understanding God's will, not to force God's hand. Our time in prayer ought to be spent seeking God's face and learning his will rather than, "God, remember, you said this and you said that." Prayer is designed to bring us to that place where we realize that we are utterly 100% dependent on God. God is trying to break us of our self-sufficiency. And the world psychologists, well, they'll tell you, you know what? It's a bad thing to be codependent. Let me rephrase that. Codependency? We were designed to be codependent. There's nothing wrong with codependency. I know, I'm a heretic. Freud is very upset with me. He's rolling in his grave. No, we were designed to be codependent. The problem is when we become codependent with another codependent person. Our codependency is supposed to lead us to a relationship with God where we become dependent on God. But what we do is we become idolaters when we become codependent of the people around us, even our spouse. We are not designed to be codependent of our spouse, of our father, or of our mother, of our children. That's unhealthy codependency, I would agree. But we've been designed to be codependent because we are not self-sufficient individuals. We are designed to need God. And it's true that we've been designed to also have an adhesiveness. There is supposed to be a bond between us and our spouse, us and our children, us and our friends. But our dependency ought to be 100% on God. Jacob has been self-sufficient. Jacob has manipulated his situation. He has forged his path. He's a self-made man. He's pulled himself up by his own bootstraps and paved his way. And God has brought him through situation after situation after situation, saying, okay, you didn't learn it on this one. I have to bring you into another one now. Oh, you didn't learn it again. Okay, here we go again. And now he's bringing Jacob. He led Jacob back to Esau, the very person who swore to kill him, to bring Jacob to that place where he is finally broken of his self-sufficiency. And so he continues to pray in verse 11. Deliver me, I pray, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, lest he come and attack me and the mother with the children. For you said, I will surely treat you well and make your descendants as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for a multitude. So Jacob confesses his fear to God, and we ought to also confess our fears to the Lord as well. God already knows. But there is something to be said for that time we spend with God where we confess what we're going through to Him. Because it's at those points and times that we're open to the comfort of the Holy Spirit. And so we need to come before the Lord, and we ought to confess our fears to God. But the end of his prayer seems to me to be a sort of tugging at the heart of God's heartstrings, if you will. And we do it to one another, don't we? We try to manipulate each other through the emotional tugs, you know, and you get the big puppy dog eyes, and even some people know how to cry on command, and I know some of you guys do that, you know. You know how to make yourself cry, you know, and all of a sudden everybody's doing everything you want. And that's what Jacob's trying to do here. He's crying on command. The end of his prayer seems to be this tugging at the heartstrings of God. But God, what about the women and the children? Oh, poor Jacob. You wouldn't hit a guy with glasses, would you? That's what he's doing here. When we pray, we don't have to spend time manipulating God. God knows the beginning from the end. Spend our time in prayer trying to learn God's will. Well, verse 13 says, so he lodged there that same night and took what came to his hand as a present for Esau, his brother. 200 female goats and 20 male goats, 200 ewes and 20 rams, 30 milk camels and their colts, 40 cows and 10 bulls, 20 female donkeys and 10 foals. Then he delivered them to the hand of his servants, every drove by itself, and said to his servants, pass over before me and put some distance between successive droves. So basically he's got this big pomp and circumstance parade of animals. He's sending maybe the small ones first. Here's some sheep. Oh, here's some goats. Oh, here's some horses. Oh, here's some camels, lions and tigers and bears. Oh my. And he's sending these troops of animals, with his messengers, he's sending these animals as gifts to Esau. Wait. Did we read where God said send all this livestock? Maybe we passed over some verses. No, it's not there. He's, again, trying to manipulate the situation. That's why I don't believe that his prayer was like this heartfelt prayer that he's really just trying to get with God's plan here. No, he's trying to manipulate God. Now he wakes up and he's like, okay, now I'm going to manipulate my brother. I'm just going to send a bunch of stuff because he was supposed to get a bunch of stuff, but I kind of bilked him out of that, you know. And God didn't tell him to send all these animals. He's doing it himself. He's, again, still trying to manipulate the situation. And God's up in heaven just going, oh, come on. What am I going to have to do with you? What is it going to take to help you understand that I didn't say, did I say send the animals? I didn't say send the animals. Why are you sending the animals? What are you doing, Jacob? Verse 17. And he commanded the first one, saying, when Esau, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, to whom do you belong and where are you going? Whose are these in front of you? Then you shall say, they are your servant Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esau, and behold, he also is behind us. So he commanded the second, the third, and all who followed the drove, saying, in this matter you shall speak to Esau when you find him, and also say, behold, your servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, I will appease him with the present that goes before me, and afterward I will see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. So the present went on over before him, but he himself lodged that night in the camp. I think Jacob was much like his mother. And, you know, our parents, I think, mean well. I think that we can say, you know, okay, mom and dad mean well. They didn't mean to mess us up. But the fact of the matter is that mom and dad are sinful people. You know, they have sinful ideas and they commit acts of sin. And we watch that. And we think, oh, that's the way it's supposed to go. Or we think that's not the way it's supposed to go, but we're just kind of locked into that way of thinking now. And we continue to have similar ideas about how to go about life and fixing life's problems. It's a burden on parents because, boy, I mean, the more Christ-like we can be, hopefully the more Christ-like our kids will be. The more un-Christ-like we are, well, vice versa. Jacob was much like his mother. And we saw how his mother manipulated various situations. We see Jacob manipulating his brother Esau out of his birthright. We find Jacob manipulating his father out of Esau's blessing. He manipulated Rachel and he manipulated Leah and Laban, and he has basically manipulated every situation that we've read about so far. He even tried to manipulate God in his time of prayer. Now he's trying to manipulate Esau again by sending this parade of animals, by appeasing him. And this was part of the customs of the culture at this point in time. You would pay homage to a king and you would send before you these gifts. But now the question is Esau Jacob's king or is God Jacob's king? Because Jacob is treating Esau like the king, where God is just saying, just go down here. I'm not telling you to do anything else, just go. And he should be paying homage to the God of the Bible, not paying homage to Esau. God did not tell him to send that present of animals. And Jacob is trying to help God with God's will. Anybody here ever find themselves trying to help God to make God's will happen? You know, I mean, just God probably just gets tired. I mean, the Bible says he rested on the seventh day, right? So he must have been a little tired or something. And so, you know, we got to help him a little bit. I mean, just a little bit, but just enough, right? And so we start manipulating situations. But now we see God step in, because at some point in time, guys, at some point in time, gals, understand that all of your helping at some point in time is going to come to an end, because God is going to help you to come to that place where you can finally just say, I can't do it. I can't control this situation. It's beyond me. And then God steps in. Then God comes and starts dealing in your life on that issue. Verse 22 says, and he arose that night and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 sons, and crossed over the ford of Jabbok. He took them, sent them over to the brook, and sent over what he had. Then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day, or the breaking of his hip, one or the other. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint, and he wrestled with him. And he said, let me go, for the day breaks. But he said, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Who was this man that Jacob was wrestling with? Hosea, if you'd like to turn there very quickly, Hosea 12:2 gives us more insight into this WWF wrestling ring here. In one corner you have Jacob. We don't know his weight or his stage name, but I'm sure he had like animal pelts on or something. In the other corner was none other than a theophany. And in Hosea 12, verse 2, it says, "Now the Lord is bringing a lawsuit against Judah. He is about to punish Jacob for all his deceitful ways. Before Jacob was born, he struggled with his brother. When he became a man, he even fought with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and won. He wept and pleaded for a blessing from him." What's a theophany? Well, very quickly, a theophany is, again, the visible appearance of God as a human being. We've read several instances where a character of the Bible throughout the book of Genesis have seen a theophany. Starting in early on in the book of Genesis, when Adam and Eve walked with God in the cool of the day. Chances are they were walking with a theophany, a part of God who takes on a sort of human-like appearance. But here we see Jacob wrestling with this theophany. Again, Hosea 12:3 says, "He struggled with his brother, he became a man, and even fought with God. Yes, he wrestled with the angel and won." So this is none other than the angel of the Lord, which the Bible talks about at points in times, the angel of the Lord being one of these theophanies, an appearance of God in some form that looks like a man. So Jacob wrestled with the theophany, and you know, as he's wrestling with this man that is God, God obviously holding back, right? I mean, he's holding back, come on. It's kind of like, you know, you fathers, when you wrestle with your son, you're not giving him everything, right? If you are, we need to talk, you know. Don't be giving your son everything. But he's holding back, like a good father does wrestling with his son. But you know how when you're wrestling with someone, like recently, you know, Stephen was just really asking for it, and I had to take him down, you know, and I held a lot back. I did, trust me. But you know, there's that one move when you're really just ready to say, okay, this is over, this is it, right? And you put that final move, that arm twisting, wrist breaking move, where you know they're finally ready to scream uncle. And Stephen was screaming, you know. And I said, all right, and I let him up. That's what God's doing here. Verse 25 says that God touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was at a joint as he wrestled with him. So Jacob's thinking, yeah, I've got this guy, you know, I've got him, you know, and they wrestle all night long. And then the day starts breaking, and God just goes, let me give you a little taste of what I could have done to you. Touches his hip, and his hip is knocked out of socket now. I mean, that's hardcore power right there. I mean, you just touch someone's hip socket, and it's out of joint. Ouch. Jacob held on, though. Even with his socket out of place, hip sockets popped out there. And that's going to leave a mark, you know. I mean, that's going to hurt, you know, for a long time. He might have even been crippled from here on out. But he held on. He held on to God. And he wouldn't let God go. And God said, hey, let go of me. The day is breaking, you know. And Jacob's like, I'm not letting go until you bless me. And what we ought to learn from that is this idea that as hard as it might get, as much as we might struggle with whatever is going on in our lives, as long as we're so determined to hold on to God, as long as we determine to hold on to Jesus Christ, and life can get hard, guys. I mean, there's no doubt about it. God didn't come along and promise us as Christians that our life would get better. And the gospel that suggests that, well, become a Christian and your life becomes better, well, the Bible doesn't teach that gospel. The Bible teaches a gospel where you become a Christian and you have peace with God, so life's better in that sense. But there's a lot of other things that could get hard, like your parents, you know, rejecting you, your family, other family members rejecting you, you know, being fired for your beliefs, being persecuted. There's a lot of ways that your life can become harder as a result of becoming a Christian. No matter how hard it gets, though, as long as we're holding on to Jesus. And Jacob holds on to God, and he holds on to God, and he holds on to God, and he says, I'm not letting go until you bless me. Isn't that awesome? I mean, don't you wish that you could live with that kind of determination? Because so many times, if we just held on a little bit longer, we would experience what God wanted for us. I'm not going to say that we have to hold on to God with all of our might before God could bless us. God blesses us every day. Every breath is a new blessing from God. But what I'm saying is that there's a special blessing that comes from holding on to God, from persevering, from being patient through the struggles, and making it to that place where God really wants to reveal something new about Himself to us. And He wants to reveal something new about us that He knows but we don't. And He wants to get us to that place where He can change us just a little bit more and make us a little bit more like Christ. And those are the kind of blessings that come when we hold on to Christ, when we continue to hold on to God. Verse 27 picks up. So he said to him, what is your name? He said, Jacob. And he said, your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed. Then Jacob asked him, saying, tell me your name, I pray. And he said, why is it that you ask about my name? And he blessed him there. It's kind of cryptic, kind of, good answer. But verse 30 goes on and says, so Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved. Just as he crossed over Penuel, the sun rose on him and he limped on his hip. So is there a contradiction in the Bible? The Bible says that no one has seen God face to face, but here at this point in time, Jacob says that he has seen God face to face. Is that a contradiction? Actually, no, it's not. I mean, the fact of the matter is that no one has seen God face to face. And at this point in time, he's not looking at the face of God. He's looking at a theophany, a manifestation, if you will. You know, God is presenting kind of a hologram or something. But to see God face to face, no one in this lifetime could look at God face to face. Isn't Jesus God in the flesh? Yes, he is. But he's 100% God clothed in 100% humanity. And so by looking at the face of Jesus, you're looking at the child of Mary, not the Son of God. At some point in time, they got to see a little bit of his glory as they went up to the Mount of Transfiguration. And three of the disciples sit there and watched, a little bit of his glory seep out. That would have been pretty cool. But even at that point in time, they didn't look at God face to face. They didn't see the fullness of God. No one has seen the fullness of God. That's what it means to look at him face to face. But here, there's been a wrestling match between this theophany of God and Jacob, and so he says that he's seen him face to face, but that doesn't mean the same as seeing God face to face, like you've seen the fullness of God. No one could ever do that. Genesis 32:32 goes on and says, therefore, to this day, the children of Israel did not eat the muscle that shrank, which is on the hip socket, because he touched the socket of Jacob's hip in the muscle that shrank. Interesting, but I won't comment on it. God changed this man's life, though, and he's no longer Jacob, though we'll probably call him Jacob a few more times, but he's now Israel. He's received a new name, which is resembling his new, broken, no longer self-sufficient life. Now God can really use Jacob. You see, Jacob was the heel catcher. He was the supplanter. He was the manipulator. And now he's wrestled with God. God's brought him to a place where he can no longer manipulate his situation. He can't force his way out. He can't con his way out. And he had to rely completely on God. Now he's Israel. He was Jacob. Now he's Israel. Israel means God prevails. And the question is, will we learn a lesson from Jacob's life? Especially, as we see him going through all the manipulation and finally coming to that place where God brings him, where God breaks him, and where God remakes him as Israel. But it takes allowing God to prevail in your life. I mean, that's what it really does. It takes coming to that place where we finally admit that, no, we can't do it. That we aren't self-sufficient, that we are codependent and need to find that God is the one that we are codependent with. Will you allow God to prevail in your life? That's the question. Will you allow God to prevail? Will you stop manipulating the situation and start praying to the one who can control the situation? Will you today confess that you've spent too much time as a Christian on the throne and not allowed God enough time on the throne in your life? God wants to take care of us. And I remember I was at dinner or lunch with Brenda here recently, and there was this little cute little girl, just so innocent, and you knew she couldn't do anything. She was barely walking. And Big Dad was holding her hand and helping her to walk along, and we were in this little restaurant, and Brenda just looked at me and said, "That's how we are with God." And I said, "Yeah, that's right. That's right. We are like this helpless little kid that doesn't know what tomorrow brings, that doesn't even understand the concept of tomorrow, only knows that Dad's helping us walk right now." The sad thing is that we're almost too smart for ourselves at times, because we forget that we need to continue to hold on to Daddy's hand to walk right. And we grab our hand away and we start trying to walk, and lo and behold, we fall and scrape our knees, and we blow it because we stop being codependent on God and we start trying to manipulate our own situation. So the question is, will you let God be your daddy? Will you let God take care of you? Will you let God help you walk? Or do you want to continue to try to control your situation, manipulate your future, and mess it up until God finally touches your hip and allows you to become crippled in some form or fashion so that you'll finally say, "I need God. I need to depend 100% of the time on 100% of God." That's where He wants to bring us. And so you can get there the easy way, or you can get there Jacob's way. Either way, Christian, God's going to get you there. And that's the greatest thing of all. He's not going to leave you where you are right now. We can thank Him for that. Let's pray.